Let's Talk Outdoors is recorded on the homelands of many nations, including the Cree, Soto, Assiniboine, Dene, Dakota, Lakota, Nakota, and Métis nations on the Treaty 6 and Treaty 4 territories. We encourage you to always learn more about the stories of the land on which you live, work, and play.
I'm Justine.
And I'm Leah, and this is Let's Talk Outdoors. Today we are talking with Megan James about inclusive outdoor play.
Megan is sharing tips, tricks, and strategies for getting children with varying abilities outside.
Welcome to Let's Talk Outdoors, Megan. Can you tell us a bit about your background and what got you interested in outdoor education?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for our conversation this evening. So my name is Megan James. I am a postdoctoral fellow at the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario in Ottawa, Ontario. My background, I completed my master's of kinesiology and my doctor of philosophy in kinesiology at the University of Toronto. And my research has largely focused on early childhood development and has looked at how we can promote inclusive physical activity so that all children have equal and equitable access to play and to activities that can help them grow and develop and be healthy.
So the language around inclusivity is ever-changing and can be confusing to some of us. Can you share with us your interpretation and experience around language and differing abilities?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, tonight we'll be speaking about children with disabilities, I think it's really important to have this kind of conversation right at the beginning about the importance of language and the language we use in our practice, whether that's as an early childhood educator or a school teacher. For me, I typically refer or lean on person-first language. So by that, meaning that the person comes before the disability, so a child with a disability would be how I refer to children with disabilities. But that being said, it's really important to recognize that not all people with disabilities would prefer person-first language. And there are many groups that would prefer disability-first language. So identifying themselves with their disability, for example, an autistic individual or a disabled individual. And this is a very empowered way to refer to themselves. So something to keep in mind as we chat, and something that our listeners can keep in mind as well when they're thinking about this discussion on inclusion, is the language we use is important. And I would provide the advice of speaking to the individuals that you're working with, talk to the students in your class, see how they identify themselves. And the other piece too is, if it's not needed, you don't have to always identify a child with their disability. So sometimes it's important to include this when you're speaking, and that might be, and that's what you could think about person first, your disability first, or what kind of language you use. But just thinking about children in your class or students in your class, you know, everyone's a person and we don't always have to attach a label.
So Megan, let's say I have a bunch of students in my class with children with disabilities. What is inclusive outdoor play and how can I get those students outside?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. I'll start with talking about outdoor play. Because I think before going into, you know, what is inclusive outdoor play, it's good to define what outdoor play means. I'm working here at Itch.io Research Institute with Dr. Mark Tremblay, as well as Dr. Louise Dillanois, who both work with Outdoor Play Canada. So that's an organization that I'm conducting research with as well. And they've worked in the past on defining terms such as outdoor play and what that means. So the Play, Learn, and Teach Outdoors Network, or Play-Doh Network for short, is an international collaborative researchers who together did extensive work on defining outdoor play. So I'm going to use their definition for outdoor play, and then we can talk about what inclusive outdoor play looks like. So when we think about play in general, we see the definition as voluntary engagement in activity that is fun and or rewarding and usually driven by intrinsic motivation. And then something to keep in mind as well when we're thinking about play is that not all play is self-directed and intrinsically motivated. So that's a nuance to consider in that definition. And then when we think of outdoor play, it's this definition of play, but it's a form of play that takes place outdoors. So any form of activity that's fun and or rewarding, driven by intrinsic motivation that occurs outside. So that's how we could think about outdoor play in general. Now, when we think about inclusive outdoor play, I don't think necessarily inclusive outdoor play takes on a full other definition from how we would define outdoor play. It's more thinking about the social environment and what inclusion really means. So thinking about how when engaging in outdoor play, these play spaces or these activities are welcoming to students of different backgrounds, different cultural beliefs, different socioeconomic statuses, and this would also include disabilities. So we're really looking at how all children are socially accepted, they're welcomed, and equally treated in outdoor play spaces. So when we think of inclusive outdoor play, it's play that takes place outdoors that can include all children, and that's going to require, and we'll talk about that today, different modifications and different considerations, but inclusive outdoor play, when we think about defining it, we're really thinking about outdoor play that includes all children. And we're focusing today, I think, mainly on children with disabilities, but this would encompass children from diverse backgrounds, boys, girls, however children identify. So this would be, making sure that outdoor space is inclusive and accepts all children.
I like the definition. We spent at SASC Outdoors, we have an outdoor play working group, and we have spent hours upon hours, as I'm sure you have, talking about the definition of play and what is outdoor play and what is risky play. And so it's always nice to hear different people's definitions, and especially people like yourself and the Outdoor Play Canada, who have put a lot of time and research and thought into these definitions.
Absolutely. And it's good, like, definitions to a point, they're important, and it's good to know that we're talking about similar things and kind of being on the same page. But I think, especially with this conversation, we think inclusive outdoor play, we have to think a little bit outside, and like definitions of play are quite broad. So it's easy to do this, but when we really start thinking about instances of play and how we can make sure those are inclusive, that they are inclusive, that they are welcoming of all kids, we really have to start to kind of expand those definitions of what that consists of.
Our audience works with kids from zero all the way to like grade 12. So what recommendations do you have for teachers or ECEs to make inclusive play possible?
Yeah, I think, and this would go, it's going to look different in different age groups. There's considerations, and first, I'll just make a disclaimer. I'm not a teacher myself. I'm searching this area, and I've worked with parents and teachers of children, again, from a range of ages from zero to early adulthood. So I like to kind of put that out in the open, because some of the things I'm saying, it might be relevant to your practice, and you may need to kind of think about what I'm saying and then think about how that applies in your classroom as well. But the first thing that I would say is be open-minded to the possibilities and what can be done outdoors. And that goes for kids with and without disabilities. So I think when we think about making play inclusive, and we immediately think about how are we including children with disabilities, for example, like what we're talking about today. And I think it's good to remind ourselves that we need to be kind of open-minded to all children and all abilities, whether this is identified with a disability or not. And to do that, my advice would be to really kind of pay attention in your classroom to the skills of the children and the interests of the children, which can then be brought outdoors. When we think about kids with disabilities specifically, it's very helpful to, one, talk to the parent to see what are their capabilities and to really start to understand, okay, you know, if I'm trying to think about bringing my students to the forest today, what might be at the forest that may not be good for this student or this student based on my conversation with the parent. That said, when you are outside, don't be afraid to talk to the students themselves. Students, you know, children know what they're capable of, and they can let you know what they're comfortable with and what they're not comfortable with. I think it's very common that we as adults can sometimes place barriers on children that may or may not exist. And we see things differently than kids. And kids can often do a lot more than we think they can do, especially when we think of kids with disabilities. So that's kind of where I would start, is really that open mind and talking to children and their parents about what they're comfortable with, what they're interested in, so they can have a meaningful experience outdoors. The second tip would be around scaffolding activities. So when you're planning activities outside, and I mean, this isn't that different than when you're planning activities inside, but when you're thinking about outdoors, you know, what are you looking to do when you're outside with students? And how can this be scaffolded to different ability levels, whether that's physical, social, or cognitive ability levels? This may require you to bring some supports with you. So if we're talking physical disabilities, you may bring some equipment. When we're thinking social or cognitive, you know, you may bring different loose parts or have activities planned to ensure that children have an opportunity to engage with one another. So really kind of thinking about how you're scaffolding activities. And then this builds into kind of my next point around planning ahead. So it takes planning. And when you plan ahead and you think about scaffolding those activities, it can be a lot easier when you're in the forest or outdoors and you're trying to incorporate play for all children in your class. And then the last point I'll make, and I think it's a really important one, because the actual specific strategies or equipment or ways you scaffold, it's going to be different from student to student, from place to place, what you have access to, what you don't have access to in your environment. So, you know, it'd be impossible to cover it all. But what I would say is that when you have an open mind and you think creatively and you're working collaboratively with parents, with the students, with your administrators, a lot of things are possible. And the only way you find out what works and what doesn't is to try. You know, we always want to keep the kids safe. So we look at safety, make sure things are inherently safe. But then we try things and we let children explore, see what works, and we see what doesn't work. And we keep building on that.
I like your comments about having an open mind, because I think that applies to all kinds of, in my experience, all kinds of play that I'm facilitating or, you know, providing this space for, is that I can't necessarily predict what's going to happen. And so having that open mind of what play is appropriate for this person on this day, and it changes, and I have to get my own agenda out of the way sometimes.
Absolutely.
I wonder if you could give us a few examples about this scaffold, maybe some more specific examples. You're talking about scaffolding and differing abilities, you know, physical scaffolding or cognitive social scaffolding. Can you give us some more concrete examples of how you've seen that done or what that might look like?
Sure. Yeah. So let's think, most of my examples are going to come more in the early childhood space. That's just where I have most research is. But I mean, it's always good to just have a concrete example to work from. I'll keep it really basic. And I think the easiest way to wrap our heads around kind of what a scaffolding activity would look like. So if we think physical disabilities, think of a child, let's say, with cerebral palsy. So, you know, they might use some assistive aids to move around in their space. for this example, we'll assume they're not in a wheelchair, but they may have some coordination problems or balance issues that you may want to be there when you're in the forest. So we're thinking about going to the forest. So, for example, in scaffolding, so you may have a destination where you're going, and you have, when you go to the space, and this is another kind of tip, I guess, in planning ahead and thinking about, okay, these are the students in my class, this is where I'm going, this is what the landscape looks like. In, when we think about scaffolding, we can think about providing students choice. So making sure that there are more than one route options to get to the place where you're going. So, you know, you might have a route that has a lot more logs and sticks on the ground and whatnot, and that may be fine. And you know, a child who does have some troubles with balance may still choose that route. That's fine. But really looking at what are the choices? Is there options? So if this is too difficult for some children, is there a path that has less obstacles? Or, you know, is there a way that I can manipulate the environment so there are less obstacles? Scaffolding, when we think of providing assistive equipment, I'll use an example here at the Forest School, the Ottawa Forest and Nature School here. They had worked with an organization, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, and they brought children with visual impairments into the forest for a day of play. And some educators were concerned about the safety with, do we need to clear the sticks? Or do we need to like make sure the space is clear from the tree so it's not poking them in the eyes or something that is dangerous? And CNID replied and said, you know what? We'll give them goggles to actually protect their eyes. And then they can play. They can play like every other child. And, you know, it was adding, let's say, some bells and noisemakers to some of the activities. But beyond that, you know, we look at the safety. So then we can, okay, so we're not to the point of dangerous, but then we can actually do a lot of activities and scaffold that to the abilities of the child by adding something like a bell or a beeper so that they can orient themselves in space as well.
I like that because you're not making assumptions about on behalf of someone else about what they are capable of or what choice that they want to make on that particular day.
Absolutely. And the choice is a big piece and it comes in. So I haven't brought this up yet, but there's a concept called quality participation, something I work on in my research. And it's quality participation. The concept is developed and studied by the Canadian Disability Participation Project, or CDPP for short. And choice is something that gets brought up a lot in how we can foster quality participation. So they define quality participation as a child's perception that their participation during play, whether through free play or a planned activity, has been satisfying, enjoyable, and resulted in the achievement of meaningful outcomes. And when we look at what promotes quality participation, choice is one of the six building blocks that CDPP refers to. And the reason why this is so important, having choice in your activities, is because that's one way that we can scaffold activities, but also provide children with the opportunity to be autonomous and to be able to have control over their activities and to, in a way, scaffold their own play. So when you're planning ahead, thinking about those different levels of challenge, and this comes back to this idea of inclusive, because you want to have activities that are enjoyable for all children in your group. And for some children, they may need lower levels of challenge. For some, they need higher levels of challenge to be engaged and to be having fun and have a meaningful experience. So scaffolding is so important when we think about inclusion as a whole. And we're not just thinking about kids with disabilities. We want all kids to be together outside and playing and enjoying themselves. So being able to scaffold is one of the most important parts.
These are really, really great suggestions. I like the idea of bringing in materials such as like the goggles so the kids could play like every other child. But with budget, sometimes we have a very limited budget of what we can spend in our daycare or in our school. So how can you incorporate the scaffolding or inclusive play if budget is an issue?
Yeah, and that is such an important piece to talk about, because I think, at least in my experience, budget gets brought up a lot as a barrier to inclusive play in general, not just speaking about outdoor play, but thinking about inclusion, especially in physical activity or activity pursuits that may require adaptive equipment. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I feel like it always comes back to a similar point. And that's around thinking outside of the box, being creative, and having an open mind. So yes, you can get specialized adaptive equipment, we're thinking about, and again, I want to be cognizant that we're not just focusing on kids with physical disabilities. But I think that often we go there and we think about kids with physical disabilities, especially when we think about the outdoors, because the outdoors and natural landscape is at odds with how we typically think about physical accessibility. So it comes up a lot, but I'm just kind of bringing that up that, this isn't the whole population of children with disabilities. But when we do think about kids with physical disabilities, we think about this. You can get adaptive equipment, you can get adaptive sleds, you can get all-terrain wheelchairs that would be incredible in the forest. And there's lots of things you can do, but those things cost a lot of money. My thoughts on that is just that that is not the only way to go outside and to play and to have fun. So working within your own constraints is important. When we think about actually purchasing equipment or things that would cost money to bring kids outside, there's lots of things we can do that are low cost. The first thing that comes to mind is, and something that's a strategy for inclusive play in general, is around bringing loose parts. So that helps us provide choice. So you're bringing loose parts that could potentially make an activity more challenging or more engaging, or for a child who, say, needs some alone time or needs to play on their own because they're potentially overstimulated in the environment, bringing some free play options to have some downtime can be really important. And these free play options and loose parts, it doesn't have to be purchased toys. These can be things found in the environment. These can be things that already exist in the school that, you bring a small bag and this is something you prep ahead of time, where you have that loose part bag that you bring outside and you've been very intentional with the sensory pieces that you put in the bag and things that you think would be important. So loose parts is one cost-effective way to bring inclusive activities outside. When we think physical disabilities, one, I'm going to say again, like we're thinking about, I think this might have been in the questions later on, so apologies if I'm skipping ahead, but around weather and how do you bring a wheelchair outside in the snow, for example. So when it comes to the adapted equipment, that's something that my advice again would be, if you're planning to go outside and to be in different weather conditions, speak to the parents about, one, what they're comfortable with. I remember speaking with a parent who had a child with a wheelchair. And one thing that got brought up that I never thought about was, okay, you can go outside, but this child only has one wheelchair. So if it gets muddy and totally beat up outside, it's a concern for the family. So really kind of talking to the family to understand what their wheelchair is capable of, one, and what they're comfortable with. And then thinking from there what you can do. Is it speaking to your administration about wagons, adaptive wagons, sleds that you may want to bring outside, so a child doesn't necessarily have to rely on a wheelchair, but you have a piece of equipment? This costs money, of course. So this would be something that would be more of a, plan ahead, a longer term solution to some of these problems. And I don't want to overlook that this is challenging, that this isn't something that can easily be done, but I think it really does start with advocacy. And in a position as an educator, you are in a position to advocate for some of these things. So with those bigger pieces of equipment, that's it, that can be challenging, and that's something to work through. But thinking outside the box in terms of what can you use that you already have that could provide assistance. We I was speaking with some early childhood educators recently about supporting quality participation outside for kids with disabilities. And a couple ideas that came up that were really great and creative is bringing like inflatable mats that are really easy just to blow up, but they're easy to carry as well. So that if a child has some challenges with mobility, you can sit them onto the ground and they can be in part of the activity and they can play in the dirt with other kids. But you bring this inflatable mat, or you bring a light foam piece that can kind of prop up, or you bring outdoor seats that allow children to be sitting, you know, outside with the other children. So not everything has to be straight to the fancy outdoor all-terrain wheelchairs. Of course, in a perfect world, this would be amazing. But there are lots of ways that you can get creative, and often to make outdoor play inclusive, it comes down to how you're teaching and how you're scaffolding and the activities you have planned. So I would encourage the listeners, whether you're a teacher or early childhood educator, is to kind of start thinking about it that way. You know, what are the activities you're doing outside? And can you select activities that are going to promote that quality experience for children, regardless of ability, in a way that doesn't require specialized equipment, for example? So I think, I don't know if that fully answers, you know, I don't think there is a perfect answer for budget. Budget's budget and things cost money. But I think getting creative, thinking outside the box, and really thinking and acknowledging that there's so much you can do to make activities inclusive that don't require money at all. It requires your open mind and your planning ahead for those activities.
I really like how you touched on varying abilities and some of the challenges you might have with varying abilities. And we talked lots about physical ability, but can you touch a little bit about students that might go into fight or freeze or flight mode?
Sure. Yeah. So, and by that, I think we're probably speaking more about children with autism spectrum disorder or anything kind of more on the behavioral side. Right. So that this is something, so actually some of my work was focused in playground spaces. So not necessarily the forest, but still an outdoor play space. And something that got brought up a lot was around being able to allow children who may have these tendencies to run off potentially in an environment, especially if they're overstimulated, which could certainly happen in a playground or an outdoor space in nature. And, you know, how do you mitigate that? And as a teacher, thinking about, you know, I have a group of students, you know, will it be a safety issue if I go out to the forest? So of course, this is going to be a case by case scenario. And it's really going to be, again, up to the educator and the adults involved to sort out, you know, what is the best way. I guess a couple more general ideas about when going outside. The first is to have clear boundaries of where the outdoor play space is going to be. So if you're going somewhere, you know, I think about the forest as an example, because this is probably the largest, most broadest place that you could go outside that, you know, you can bring things that can mark, you know, whether you're marking a tree ahead of time, you know, making sure that everyone, the children and the adults who are going with you, know the clear boundaries, positioning yourselves in places that you are able to see all of the children. And these are probably basic things that you would do regardless of a child with a disability, but things to consider when you're going outside. The other piece is to think about, you know, you word it as like the fight or flight or freeze mode. Think about, go back kind of to understanding the child. So what is it that is triggering the child to do these or to have these reactions in nature if they're happening? Is it because of overstimulation, right? Is it because it's wet outside? You know, are there things that you can do? You know, if some children have sensory processing disorders where if they get mud and whatnot on their hands, it's a problem. So maybe you bring gloves with you to have on, or maybe you give them a shovel so they don't need to be using their hands. So thinking again, kind of right back to the basics when we think about, okay, where is this stemming from? How can I address this? do I need to bring a pair of noise-canceling headphones to eliminate some of the stimulation in the environment? Should I bring a couple books? Because if I can know, if I notice a child is becoming overstimulated, or maybe the outdoors is just too much, we can sit and read, or we can do something in a quiet space where, again, options, choice, scaffolding. So really, I guess in that scenario, of course, we should think about safety. Safety, number one, in all aspects when we work with kids, not just outside. But beyond that, thinking about, like, you, there is lots of things that you can do to mitigate some of those behaviors by kind of thinking about triggers and what might be causing the fight or flight. But then on top of that, thinking about the space you're going and what's going to be the most appropriate. Is the forest where you should be going, depending on who's in your class? Maybe it's in more, maybe it's a better place to go, you know, somewhere where it's smaller, there's a fence and it's still outside and there's still nature and maybe some trees, but this might be the more appropriate place. And that's going to allow for that, again, quality experience for all children, that, you know, you can include everyone and you don't have to worry about that. So it's case by case. And it really comes down to what we talked about right at the beginning, is knowing the students, talking to the students and talking to the parents. That's, they're the experts. I mean, I don't think any of us really can have the perfect answer. I think we really have to rely on the people who know the child best, which oftentimes is the child themselves, or, you know, next closest to a parent or a caregiver. And you as the teacher, I mean, you spend so much time with them. So you can, there's probably things that if you think about the activity and you think about the challenges you're facing, then you can work with the family and the child to come up with a solution that could work with for everyone. And that comes back to the open mind and really going into it with this inclusive attitude that I want to do activities that include everyone.
I hear a lot of comments that make me think about reflection too, and the answers and things that you're sharing. Mm-hmm. It's just being a reflective educator and facilitator and taking the time that you need to think through the multitude of things that are at play, which is a really
absolutely
important skill.
So important. And I guess to that point, I want to acknowledge at the same time is just the incredibly important, but also very taxing role that educators have. There's so much that educators do. And, you know, I'm not naive to the fact that there are already so many responsibilities. And it might seem very daunting to say, okay, outdoor play is great, I want to go outside, but I already have all these things to do. Where do I find the time to sit and reflect and find ways to be inclusive? That is absolutely a valid thought to be having. I guess it goes back to the reflection and it's really kind of building new habits that are more inclusive, that are, you know, you don't have to have the perfect answer and you don't have to have the perfect equipment. But when we start to think about our activities that we're doing and thinking about all students involved and how we can try, maybe fail, maybe succeed and try again and reflect on that, it doesn't have to be a whole thing that happens on the side. It can be starting to be embedded within. And that takes a perspective shift, I think, a lot of self-reflection and, you know, a lot of, I guess, vulnerability to not know the answers. You know, there's no perfect way. I think the question gets asked so much, well, how do I do this? There's strategies and there's resources and there's things you can look at, but there's never going to be a prescription for doing this. It's just impossible because it's case by case. So for your own self and what you have control over, it's kind of shifting your mindset on how we can be more inclusive and taking that time to reflect. And that can go a really long way.
So how would you respond to those naysayers? Someone says, nope, this isn't going to work. I'm not doing it. Maybe you don't have parents that are on board. What would you say to them?
So I would first ask why. I would first want to know what are the concerns, because the concerns in all likeliness, come from a very genuine place and come from a place that is thinking about kids and thinking about their well-being. I don't think there's ever a situation where, at least in my experience, the answer is no, because they just don't want to and they don't care if it's good for the kids. It's just not something they want to do. It comes from a genuine place of thinking about the well-being and safety of kids. So first I would ask why and get an understanding of, is it physical barriers that you're worried about? Are you worried that some children will run off and you won't be able, it's not a contained space, so it's hard to keep an eye on the kids. What is it that, is it budget? Is it that, you know, the assumption is that, well, you know, there is this one child in a wheelchair and wheelchairs can't go in the forest. Well, I would tell them, well, wheelchairs can go in the forest. And you'd be very surprised on what kids in wheelchairs could do in the forest, for example. Or let's say we take that example of when the kids with visual impairments were in the forest. Oh, well, kids with visual impairments can't go in the forest because there's all these dangers that they won't be able to see. Well, this children with visual impairments, they navigate the world in a different way than us, but it doesn't mean that it's not possible or they can't be outside or they should have the opportunity to be outside. And we have to kind of expand our mind a little bit on that and check our own biases. As you know, I don't experience a disability. So that's a lot of where my self-reflection comes in, is thinking about where my biases and how I see the world is affecting how I think sometimes. So to those naysayers, I mean, I would really start by acknowledging their concerns and validating them, because I think that is important. I think it's too easy just to say, well, you should do it because this, and it's not that hard just to do this, and without acknowledging that these are genuine concerns. But then I would, you know, talk to them about kind of this mindset shift, talk to them, give them stories and anecdotes around examples. And I think that's really where I've seen educators and parents really becoming empowered in the space of inclusive, active play, outdoor play, physical activity, is when they start to see it, when they actually can see children thriving outdoors in a way that could be risky, but it's safe and it's fun for the kids and it's aiding in their development. And when you see it, then you can start to believe it. So I'd probably give some anecdotes, and then it comes, you know, providing resources. I know we might talk about that later, but there are lots of resources out there, maybe not specific to outdoor play. That's definitely an area that could grow and hopefully will grow soon. But when we think about inclusion in general, especially inclusive active play or physical activity, there's lots of resources in terms of training and ideas on bringing kids outside. So really directing them to those resources. Back down again to, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And if you're willing to do it, let's start to think about how we can make it possible. So let's kind of get out of that mindset of, you know, there's all these challenges. Let's think about what is possible, what are the opportunities, and work from there.
I hear you saying too, like, it's an educational process and it's a reflection process, and it takes lots of steps. Justine and I talk about that regularly with outdoor play in general, in terms of the school context also. And that's a lot of what you're talking about.
It's not easy. It's not a one size fits all. And I'm sure that's the discussions you have with outdoor play in general. I mean, there's barriers to outdoor play that teachers face regardless of children with disabilities. And when you think about, a child who may face barriers in the environment, it adds another layer. So it's not easy, but it certainly is possible. And, you know, we can do things and we can do them together. And it often takes kind of this whole community approach to making things happen.
Can you tell us some of the resources that you were thinking about when you were answering one of those last questions?
Sure. Yeah. So a couple. So the first one, so actually some of colleagues of ours out at the University of British Columbia, it was led by Dr. Mariana Bersoni, who is a member of Outdoor Play Canada, sits on the board, and her student, Megan Zenny. So they actually developed a tool. It's an online tool that's specific to outdoor play and how educators could bring their students outside. this tool, as far as I know, it's not necessarily specifically focused to kids with disabilities, but it provides many different tools and resources. It's an incredible app for teachers to start thinking about learning outside and how we can bring students outside. So that would be one first resource, because hopefully by now the sentiment is coming through is that lots of things can be possible and can be adapted and can be scaffolded. So the first, I think, is to think about outdoor play in general and how you're bringing kids outside. The next step then is how we make that inclusive. So now that you kind of have some ideas in mind of outdoor play, now we're thinking about how could we adapt that. And for adapting outdoor play, the one resource that comes to mind, so I spoke a little bit about quality participation. And one thing that the CDPP develops through evidence-based practices, and often, these resources, they're based in research evidence, but also in speaking with educators, parents, they've developed blueprints for supporting quality participation for individuals with disabilities in different contexts. So one of the resources, and I was personally involved in this one, was supporting quality participation on playgrounds. This blueprint isn't specific to outdoor play more broadly. It's more looking at playgrounds specifically, but playgrounds are an outdoor space. And a lot of the kind of tips and tricks and ways to support these different aspects of quality, like engagement, belongingness, challenge, these can be, using this resource. One, some of them will directly align with playing outside, and some can also be, taken and just adapted and thought about in a different way when we think about the space that we're going to. These resources, there's others. There's a jumpstart training program for play leaders, which gets at, there is an aspect of outdoor play, but it talks a lot more about how we can adapt and modify physical activity to be inclusive. Whether that's active play or whatnot. For me, I think it's, you don't necessarily need to look outside of what you're already using. So if you have a good resource that you think really helpful for inclusion in general in your classroom, it's something, maybe you've done a training or maybe you have a resource that you refer to quite often, take that and think about how you can then apply that to your outdoor learning activities that you might find, let's say, in that app that I talked about. So you might have a really cool activity, and then you go to an inclusion resource where it's like, okay, how can I ensure that this is accessible, inclusive? You might go to the blueprint to see how can I make sure that I'm fostering quality experiences for these children.
Those sound like some really good suggestions. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll link them for you. So that maybe in the notes or something, we can post.
Yes, we will put them in the show notes.
And we'll have to put them in the newsletter too for January.
That'd be great. I will also say, and because I work with Outdoor Play Canada, they have, again, it may not be specific to inclusive outdoor play, but if you go on Outdoor Play Canada's website, there is a whole section on resources for outdoor play for educators for early years. And then, thinking about what we talked about today, this podcast around how can we make this more inclusive? And, leaning on those resources that are more potentially broadly focused, because as far as I know, and I mean, I don't know every resource that's out there. I haven't seen one yet that's specific to inclusive outdoor play. But one, to anyone listening, this would be an amazing resource. Two, you can work with what's out there. And, when we think about inclusion, we're thinking about all children and how we can, and this comes down to kind of more basic principles of inclusion and not necessarily that prescriptive, approach to this is the activity, this is how it's modified, this is what you should do, because like we've said before, it's completely child dependent. And so really kind of getting yourself comfortable with basic principles of inclusion and scaffolding activities and modifying activities for different abilities, and then kind of applying that in the outdoor space.
We certainly very much enjoyed the Outdoor Play Canada resources, so I would highly recommend those to other people who are listening too. One question we have on here that we maybe have addressed, but I wanted to give you a chance to answer again if there was more things to add, was what are the considerations for people who, like myself, who don't live with a disability that we might overlook, like just it's not even on my radar of something that I could and should be thinking about?
I mean, it's a good question. I feel like I'm in a similar position because I don't experience disability. I feel like I can't fully answer the question because of that, but I think it's really thinking about, like, when you think about outdoor play and things that may come up in the environment and thinking about, I mean, this could be a whole host of things that we overlook, whether it's, you know, physical accessibility of the space. You know, is there, think about the playground, for example. Think about, okay, for if there's no ramps and there's no way to transfer onto a play structure, you know, a person in a wheelchair, a child in a wheelchair could not access that space. And that's not something, they can't go to a playground. They cannot play in that space. When we think about, let's say, thinking more on the sensory side of things, or thinking about, you know, sensory processing and what can be overstimulating in the natural environment, when we think about all of the different sounds and sights that are outside, and that can be very overstimulating to some. So I think just to that question, without having a concrete answer, but going back to that reflection and reflective process of your own implicit biases of the world and how you move through the world compared to how others move through the world. And you know, that's going to be different for different people. We all experience things differently, and disability or not, you see the world in a different way. And I think when we think about inclusion, we also have to think not just about disability, but also thinking about things like culture, for example, and how that affects how we interpret space and assign meaning to a place and what that looks like. So I don't think I have the best answer for that or something concrete. And that's largely because I feel like that's a better place for, you know, a person experiencing disability to be able to kind of share. But generally speaking, I think it's these aspects of the environment, because we live in a society that is not built for people with disabilities. And often policies, different structural, organizational aspects of programs or schools, they can be ableist and they can be really thinking about people without disabilities and making assumptions. And that's something that we have to really kind of think about and check our assumptions at the door about what people can and can't do. And that's something I think we, you know, it feeds into the question. It's not the exact answer, but it really kind of highlights again the importance of thinking about our own assumptions, thinking about our own biases, and how that affects the way that we move around the world and how that looks different. Like, I think that's the biggest piece, is that nobody's the same, and things like the way people experience different places and spaces are very different. And we need to be kind of cognizant of that when we think about our practice.
Sounds like communication is a big part of it.
Absolutely. Because you don't know without asking, right? And again, my experience, anytime I get a chance to talk to a family, or, you know, when I'm working in a program, let's say, with kids with disabilities, I remember there was a time, this is just one example, it wasn't outside, it was inside, it was a physical activity space. And, you know, we, at the end of program, we would sit in a circle and talk about, we would share like one thing that we liked the program, like give a little feedback to a friend kind of thing. And one thing I had noticed was the one child, I believe it was cerebral palsy, was sort of challenging to get to the ground and then back up again. And I remember just speaking to him one day, being like, you know, is there a better spot that we could do this gathering at the end? And his idea was to go over near the bench. He said it would be easier for him just to sit on the bench or have like people around him. So that's kind of an example of, I didn't think much of it. I thought, we're going to all go sit in a circle. everyone can sit, and it seemed to be working fine. But then, you know, you tune into, okay, this doesn't seem like it's fully working. Communicating with the person and saying, hey, what's going to work here? And that was such an easy solution, something I just totally overlooked and didn't really think about. And the solution was so easy. We just moved to the other side and sat in the bed. Like, it was super easy. So really, that communication and really speaking with the students is so important.
You highlight a very good circle there. So you have your planning, your scaffolding, you have the experience, and then you do the reflection. Like, it's a very nice circle on inclusive outdoor play.
Yeah. And I mean, I love that summary. I think there's only so much you can plan for, and then you go and do it. You have that open mind. Some things work, some things don't work at all. You know, you may plan a really, like, it goes in any space, right? I'm sure anyone listening can think of a time where you plan an awesome activity in your mind and you go and it just totally fails and the kids are like, no, this is not it. But that's the same kind of process. Try it out, see what works, see if kids are enjoying it. When your values and your goals of your practice is to be inclusive, you know, you can't really go wrong. You plan as much as you can, but you acknowledge that you can't plan at all. You accept that it's not going to be perfect, and that's okay. And that's not going to stop you from going outside the next day. You're just going to reflect, plan, and do it again. And you keep doing that, and you know what? It will never be perfect. It will never be perfect for students with or without disabilities. So I think we have to kind of think about, you know, inclusive outdoor play is not separate from outdoor play in general. It's just really this mindset shift of, how can we deal with everyone?
We've talked a lot about people in our conversation. The theme of this season of Let's Talk Outdoors is connection to place. So we have a couple of questions about that. Can you tell us what it means to be connected to place for you?
Yeah, I think I like this question. I think for me, the connection to place is when a space you're in becomes more than just a space, when it becomes something that you have an attachment to emotionally, spiritually, culturally, what that looks like. And for me, when I think of what makes a place and that meaning behind it is when there's a space that I have been in or frequently visit, and it becomes a place when I go back to it and there are memories attached to it. There are feelings attached to it. And it's really this kind of emotional grounding. When I think about places and meaningful places to the places that I have gone back and returned to and spent time on and created these memories, whether that was, you know, with others or just with myself through reflection time, you know, that's when you kind of connect and really kind of build that, I guess, emotional bond with the physical space that you're in.
So you talked lots about memories and having that connection. So where is one place that you feel connected to?
Yeah, I think about, so growing up, I did a lot of camping. That's where my family spent a lot of time in the summers. So I think about, it's a provincial park in Ontario called Triskeel Provincial Park, a beautiful park. It's on Lake Ontario. There's, so that's kind of a place in general, but there's a specific spot that I really think about. It's on a rock beach there. And I think about that place that holds a lot of meaning because I have visited that specific place many times in my childhood. And now as an adult, I've been able to go back and do, you know, experience my own camping with, you know, new significant people in my life and create new memories. And to me, that place, when I'm there, I'm outside, I'm listening to the water, you know, you're smelling the fresh air. It brings back these memories of camping, these memories of friends and family. And that's something that really sticks out to me. And it kind of carries through to other places because this idea of the water and the fresh air and the beach, for me, I'm very drawn to place water. So I'm very fortunate to live near the Ottawa River. So I'll spend time walking near the river. And again, it's not the exact same place as Presqu'ile Provincial Park, but it's this connection now and the meaning behind kind of being near water and the sounds that kind of come with that and that connection there. And then to me, that's somewhere that I think is a special place for me. And I always look forward to going back there and visiting.
It's a beautiful answer. Thank you for sharing that. As we wrap up, is there anything that you wanted to add that we didn't get a chance to ask you about?
No, I think this was an amazing discussion. I think I hope that the listeners aren't leaving thinking, well, I don't have the answer for XYZ. I don't have this kind of menu to go and do it. And I guess I'll leave off with saying that's very intentional. And it's intentional that, and kind of how I approach this space, that this isn't prescriptive. And we get through, we make outdoor play inclusive by being open-minded, by being creative, and working together and really coming together as a community.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight, Megan.
Of course. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Justine, what were your biggest takeaways from this conversation with Megan?
So I do teach students from grade 1 to 6 with lots of diverse abilities and backgrounds. So I am going to try a lot of the different strategies that Megan shared, especially in the areas around sensory processing and mobility. Leah, what were your biggest takeaways?
I really liked her comments and research around quality experience and quality participation and how important choice is in that experience. So I'm looking forward to looking into some of the blueprints that she mentioned and learning a bit more about that so I can include that in my teaching practice.
This podcast is created by Sask Outdoors. Find us online at saskoutdoors.org, where you can find more episodes and share with us ideas on future episodes you'd love to hear. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend.